Good afternoon, everybody. Today's Friday, May 10th, 2019. The Senate Finance Committee, we are calling the meeting to order at 1:40. So, we are in the Senate Finance Room, Alaska State Capitol. And present at the moment is Senators Olson, Senator Wilson, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Hoffman, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Bishop, Senator Stedman, and Senators Von Hemoff, and Senator Schauer is here with us. So the two co-chairs are way on other state business, and we're going to continue from this morning's discussion on HB 49, crime, sentencing, et cetera, et cetera. So it's all about crime. Our agenda today is for this afternoon. We're going to begin with Ms. Kelly Howell from the Department of Public Safety answering a question from this morning. And Kelly, I see you're already there at attention, ready to go. So if you'll put yourself on the record, and floor is yours, and then I'm sure we'll have questions from committee members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. And I'm here this afternoon to respond to questions that the committee had regarding Section 102 of the bill that is before you on page 69, which would require the court to transmit to the Department of Public Safety records of involuntary commitment going back to 1981. I believe the question from Madam Chair was, why do we need this? And to be completely frank, the reason we need this is to prevent another Virginia Tech shooting from occurring in Alaska.
Thank you. Any questions from Senator Machicki? Before he goes, can I interject that in the room we have Senator Keel from downtown Juneau here with us? Thank you, Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For folks that are supporters of gun rights, tell me what something 35 years ago might have to do. Is there a federal law that we're complying with? Is there something else? Because someone could have had an episode 35 years ago that may not be relevant to their behavior today. Why does that matter, and what do you see that process looking like if there was an incident back then?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, this is a federal law, so there are several federal prohibitors that would prohibit someone from being able to purchase or possess firearms, and being involuntarily committed is one of those federal prohibitors. Currently, the Alaska court system does transmit those records to the Department of Public Safety, but they only transmit them from involuntary commitments that occurred from October 2014 forward. So what this bill will do is allow those records to be transmitted to the Department of Public Safety back from 1981, which is the date that those statutes providing for the involuntary commitment of individuals became effective. And to answer your question, Senator, regarding individuals who potentially were involuntarily committed, and again, this is a legal proceeding. There is a legal finding by a judge. There is due process provided. But assuming that someone did have an involuntary commitment, there is a process in law for a relief from that legal disability where someone can petition the court. That information is also transmitted to the Department of Public Safety, and then that person's information is removed from the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, which is the federal system that's used by federal firearm licensees to check for a person's eligibility to purchase a firearm.
Follow up, Senator Machicki.
What if we chose a different timeline and decided to nullify the difference? What is at risk if we were to make such an action? Say we decided that 20 years was adequate. Is there federal funding, or is there something at risk if we were to make that decision?
So, Senator Machiki, through the chair, the NICS system, the database, is only as good as the records that are in it. And so the goal is to provide as much information to that database in order to prohibit those who are currently federally prohibited from being able to lawfully purchase, otherwise purchase a firearm. So the risk would be we wouldn't have the records from whichever date we decided to go forward. There are federal funds available. This is actually a priority at the national level. The Department of Justice has prioritized funding in specific federal grant programs, one of which was it's in response to a federal act that was passed as a result or in the wake of the Virginia Tech shooting. That individual did have a prohibiting mental health history in the state of Virginia. That information was not transmitted by the state to the NICS database, and that shooter was able to go to a federal firearms licensee and purchase the firearms that were used to kill 32 people. So the goal is to get as many records as possible into the database. It is not to infringe on any individual's rights. If someone has an involuntary commitment, they are currently federally prohibited. We just don't have that information to be able to put that into the database.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up, Senator Machiki. So, Senator Wilson is on deck, and I see Senator Olson's getting ready.
So just a follow-up. So what you're saying is, say someone was struggling with post-war PTSD back in 1985 and had an involuntary commitment, and they ended up having dealing with the issue and had 25, 30 years of success, they would likely have a case to be able to hunt with their son or grandson at some point in the future. It's not a given that they would lose their right. It's simply a process that is individually evaluated.
Senator Machiki, that's correct. There is a process, a legal process, to relieve someone from that prohibition to purchase or possess firearms.
Thank you. Senator Wilson.
Pascal, just for clarification and understanding, this would only would qualify for FFL dealers in the state, but there's just that easy loophole. I mean, we could just, someone that has one of those issues or conditions could just go to where your gun show and just pick up a firearm that doesn't require that. So is that really needed then? I understand the data information, but we have this larger sort of loophole that doesn't really apply to our state because we don't require those items. I'm just trying to understand sort of the larger context of would it really make a great difference in our state to have the additional information.
Senator Wilson, through the chair, I understand your question and I understand the issue. Certainly if someone is determined to obtain a firearm, there are other ways of doing it. And what we are doing with this bill is saying that this is one thing that we can do. It's one effort that we can put forward that could help. So although there are other alternatives and ways for people to obtain firearms, even if they legally should not have them, this is something that we as a state can do, and I think we should do.
Thank you. Senator Schauer. Oh, excuse me. Senator Olson, I believe, was in the queue for a question. I'm sorry. Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Howell, the nationwide movement has been to go ahead and try and stop the government from, or at least put some inhibitions and some guidelines or some fence ring around some of the data that the government has got on different people that are out there. How do we make sure the ACLU or somebody like that doesn't come after us based on this older data that may or may not be useful, which is fairly cumbersome to go ahead and dig in there? I see the validity of trying to avoid the Virginia Tech type of situation, but the idea that you're going to go ahead and start this Armageddon type, everybody knows about everybody kind of similar to what happened during World War II when the Nazis were taking over and they're keeping records on everybody. How do we go ahead and lay that segment of society?
Thank you, Senator Olson, through the chair. I can tell you that there are very stringent and strict confidentiality rules to protect this information. The NICS database can only be used for this specific purpose, as can the information that the court is transmitting to DPS. Mm-hmm. We do not retain that information for any other reason other than to submit it to the NICS database. It is confidential both at the state level as well as the federal level. So there are those protections in place under federal law that restrict the access and use of this information.
No further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Olson. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The good news is we never get hacked, so you know we'll never have release of personal information. That is not up to you. It's a problem we all face. That was a joke. Because I hear what he's saying, that there's some validity to that, a lot of it. I have two questions specifically. One, how many people, because we went through this already, multiple committees, how many people does this affect? And then the question we had that was never really answered, because we were going to try to look at an amendment to reduce the time and try to chop this back some, is that one of our concerns was you have Grandpa that wants to go hunting with his kids, whatever, and he had an episode 40 years ago. He's been clean since then, and all of a sudden he gets pulled over for a broken taillight, and now he's got a felony. He's got something sitting on his record, gets arrested for it, going, holy cow, I didn't even know it was coming. So there was the issues we didn't resolve of how do you notify people that something's changed, they're back in the system that weren't. There's a host of concerns we have on this, and I've never seen those answered yet. So I still have concerns about how this would play out, quite a few of them, actually. So could you answer those two, at least specifically up front?
So Senator Schauer, through the chair, the second question was the individual may not know that they're federally prohibited. Is that what your question was? Or
in essence, yes. So, you know, you have somebody, again, who's been clean for 40 years, 30 years, whatever, and this is all gone in the past, and they have a gun, they've had it for a long time, whatever, and he's driving along and gets pulled over by a trooper because he had a bad taillight. And all of a sudden there's something in the system. If my point is, any may have a weapon on him that he's had for 30 years, and there's been no problem, and all of a sudden there is. So one, it seems like, again, we never really got a satisfactory answer, I think, to how you're going to solve that. And the second question was the numbers, what we're facing. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. So to answer the first question then, I believe Ms. Mead from the court system has testified to the number of records that there are. So I don't know. I mean, the Department of Public Safety wouldn't have any idea. We don't know what we don't know, right? The court system maintains those records, so they would be the agency to answer how many people they think that would potentially affect. We may have Ms. Catherine Monfreda online, Director Monfreda, who actually oversees the databases here in the state and the transmission of that information. What I can tell you is that, you know, when any time, and Senator, I'm sure you're aware of this, when you purchase a firearm, you do fill out a specific form, an ATF form from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, and you have to answer specific questions. And those specific questions deal with, you know, are you a convicted felon? Have you been convicted of misdemeanor crime involving domestic violence? All of those federal prohibitors. And, you know, one of those is, have you been involuntarily committed to an institution for more than 30 days? Those individuals hopefully are filling out that form correctly, because to do so, to not be truthful on that form, is a crime in and of itself. So I would hope that folks are answering that legally, truthfully. If the individual has that involuntary commitment, again, they can petition the court to have that relief from disabilities.
Follow up, sir.
I understand, but Senator Wilson already highlighted a problem. He either has had the weapon for a long time, since before even, or he bought it 40 years ago before all this stuff came up and the issues, and he bought it from his neighbor, from a gun show, whatever. Never filled out that paperwork. Never been informed of it. And I guarantee you there's a whole bunch of people potentially in that category up here that have been carrying firearms, doing this their whole life. What's going to happen when, because that's the answer we never got, what's going to happen when you put all that in this database now, and it's now reported, and it's in there, and they get pulled over, something happens, whatever, through the system? What are we setting people up for that don't know all of these things and have never gone through the process? That's my question, that we've never got a good answer what we're potentially setting people up for here. That's our concern.
Senator Schauer, through the chair, You know, I'm not law enforcement, so I wouldn't be able to answer how a law enforcement officer would handle that. The systems that they check when they make contact with an individual is the Public Safety Information Network, or APSIN. They don't check the NICS database when they make contact with someone. What information is in APSIN would probably identify whether or not that person should or should not have a firearm. It's a question I would like to provide additional follow-up once I consult with some law enforcement, some of our law enforcement experts. And I could also, Mr. Chairman, I don't know whether we have Director Monfreda online and whether she could maybe add a little more to that response if she's available.
You do have a lifeline here.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just thought I'll be done with this line of questioning. I wanted to bring it up because we looked at this multiple times over the last 4 months. And the question became, the guy's sitting there with a gun. He's got a firearm in his car, tells the trooper, all's good. He's been 40 years, and it's in the system. And all of a sudden, it leaks up, and he's like, oh, you were voluntarily committed. And the guy's like, what? And he's like, you got a firearm. You're now a felon in possession of a firearm. What did we just do to that guy or gal? That's my question. And again, I go back to, I've never heard a really good answer for what we're potentially doing. That's what I'm trying to drive at here. Thank you.
Would Kelly, I think you do have a lifeline here. I don't know how in-depth Catherine can go into this, if you want her to take a stab at the hypothetical.
Sure. I will defer to Director Monfreda and see if she can add a little more.
Okay.
My response.
Ms. Monfreda, you're online following the conversation. Does Senator Schauer need to repeat, or did you catch the gist of the question and can answer?
Yes, sir. I heard the question. For the record, my name is Catherine Monfreda. I'm the director of the Division of Statewide Services with the Department of Public Safety. And regarding the question as far as somebody being stopped at a traffic stop and having a firearm in their possession, the database that the prohibited person's file is maintained by is not accessible by law enforcement at all. So they would not know that this person was in the NICS indices.
Okay, so I just heard Senator Schauer, you're ready to follow up. Go ahead, sir.
I am. You could come up with a dozen scenarios. The point is, find one that works, because that was the one we line of questioning before. And so gets a ticket because he was speeding. I don't know, name the scenario, and somehow he ends up in the system. The question we have is that person now going to be charged with felony possession of a firearm without even knowing that they're doing that? Are we setting them up to be a felon because we're going backwards and they're not being notified and they don't know? That's the question. I can't get an answer for it. If it happens to somebody somewhere through the system, it may not be in a stop, but they go to court and now they're looking at it. That's the question. I've never gotten a satisfactory answer.
So, Senator Schauer, through the chair, I'll try, and then Kathy can probably add, or Director Monfreda can probably add more to that. But as Director Monfreda stated, the NICS system, the NICS database, is not a database that law enforcement use. The sole purpose of the NICS database is for federal firearms licensees. So that information regarding voluntary commitments is in the NICS database. It is not in APSIN. We do not maintain that information in the criminal history repository system that law enforcement check when they make contact with an individual. So involuntary mental health commitments are in NICS, not accessible by law enforcement.
What, Mr. Skidmore, would you want to come up to the table here and maybe slide in there next to Kelly and give us, you've been listening to the conversation, so would you like to add anything?
Good afternoon, Chairman, members of Senate Finance. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I'm the director of the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law. As I've been listening to the conversation, I've pulled open my statute book and I'm looking at Alaska statutes 1161, 190, misconduct involving weapons in the first degree, going through all of the misconduct involving weapons, which goes to 220. And I'm looking to see if there's anything in here that would actually result in it being a crime for the person to have the firearm under the circumstances that you've described. I heard you talk about being a felon in possession. One of the things I would want to clarify is the person hasn't committed a felony. That's not what we're talking about. This is not a felon in possession. And I'm working my way through the statutes. I haven't yet found a subsection of the statute that addresses this. It doesn't mean it's not in there. I'm still looking. But if you give me a few more minutes, if you guys want to go on, I promise you before we're done today, I will come back and tell you if there's a subsection in Alaska statutes that address this concept. I'm looking for that right now.
We're going to take a brief at ease and switch out chairs. Back on the record, Ms. Goldstein, if you could pick up where you left off, and I'll catch up to you.
Mr. Chairman, I believe we were waiting for Mr. Skidmore to
Mr. Chairman, I have a question. While Mr. Skidmore's doing his thing, just to keep the flow going here at the table.
Hold it for a second. I think it's Kelly Howell, correct? Right, I jumped one down the list, so I'm sorry about that. Go ahead, Senator Bishop.
Thank you. And could you refresh me, is this the NICS database, is that controlled by the FBI?
Senator Bishop, through the chair, yes it is.
Thank you.
Okay. We have other questions? Okay, go ahead and continue.
So for the committee, this is John Skidmore again. I've finished my review of misconduct involving weapons in the state of Alaska. I find no subsection of any of our state statutes that would make it a crime to possess a firearm under these circumstances. I've been advised that there may be a federal statute. I'm not an expert in federal statutes. I don't have those in front of me. I cannot answer that question, but I can tell you there is not a state crime associated with this conduct.
Senator Bishop.
Just to follow up.
The better half is here, so make it a good question.
Uh-oh. So, but on that point, you see no rub with state statute, but if we go down this road, hypothetically, this person could be in another state where another state law, it could be an issue.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, I can't advise you of what other state laws say. What I can tell you is that what the federal law says right now is that if a person has been committed under these circumstances, that they are not to be possessing a firearm. And what we're doing in the law here isn't changing their legal status. All we are doing is ensuring that the information is available. But it doesn't change the legal status. What you're concerned about is that legal status, and I don't know what the federal law says. I can't tell you what other state laws say, but the status remains the same regardless of what those statutes would say.
Thank you.
We have other questions? Okay. You're all done, so we're going to go on to the next up. We'll hear from the Public Defender's Office. And they're online, is that correct?
Through the chair, this is Beth Goldstein, the interim public defender for the Public Defender Agency for the state of Alaska. With respect to the PDA's fiscal note, OMB component number 1631, I'm prepared to speak to that. At this point, we have a positive fiscal note of $1.3 million. We base that fiscal note on the fact that we will need 5 new attorneys and 5 new staff positions. We break that up this way. Based on the increased felony drug cases that the Department of Law has determined would occur due to this legislation, of approximately 740 felony drug cases, we anticipate that of that 740, about 19% of those cases will not come to the Public Defender Agency based either on people not being eligible for public defender counsel or conflicts to the agency. So that leaves about 600 cases that we anticipate, new cases that will be coming to the Public Defender Agency. We look to the American Bar Association guidelines to determine how many cases an attorney should handle per year. And for basic felony cases, which is what drug cases are, it's about 150 cases per year per attorney. And that gets us to our 4 attorney positions. The driving without a license recriminalization adds another attorney position. We're asking for 5 staff positions based on the fact that the Public Defender Agency is already incredibly lean on staff to attorney positions, meaning I have units who have 11 attorneys to 2 staff, 28 attorneys to 6 staff. And so in order to absorb all these new cases, instead of adding even more attorney positions, we're asking for additional staff positions.
Well, previous to Senate Bill 91, is this in addition to the several years ago? And did you have substantial layoffs between now and then, and you're adding back, or is this a total add?
Through the chair, we did not have layoffs, but we have kept positions vacant for budget reasons, and we've been able to handle those current caseloads. Although caseloads are high, we have kept at least 4 attorney positions vacant in addition for budget reasons, and those are pre-SB 91 positions. The other issue that we are having is there are recruitment issues, so there have been even more attorney and staff positions vacant. There are substantial recruiting problems right now within the legal services defense industry in the state.
So if I went back and compared your budget previous to 91, Senate Bill 91 to now, is it going to be equal to or greater than?
Chair, I would need to pull those budget numbers. I don't know. I was not the public defender at that time, but I would be happy to do that if you would like me to.
We can do that internal comparison. I just am concerned about these heavy fiscal notes on the back of supposed savings coming with 91, and now we're unraveling it, going back to where we were a few years ago, and the concern is the budget just increases year over year over year. So we'll be scrubbing that at the committee level. Do we have any questions for Ms. Goldstein? Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Goldstein, do you have any concerns with the bill?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, as the bill is right now, any concerns we have been addressed by provisions that have been taken out.
Go ahead, Senator Wilikowski.
Some of the suggested topics are the marriage defense issue. Do you have any opinion on whether that should be included as it was written, I think, in Senate Bill 35?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, we have a problem with the marriage defense issue, specifically two ways it relates to individuals that may be caught up innocently in behavior, and that is the folks with dementia. We have many situations where under the sexual assault 1 statute, the spouse of another spouse with dementia may be their guardian. Dementia is not a static disease. It comes and goes. Lucidity comes and goes. I understand that there is an assertion by the Department of Law that they would look into those situations and maybe charge or maybe not charge. And the person could easily have given consent, understood what was going on during that time period. Spouses with dementia, you know, you can have situations where for even for weeks, the spouse who has dementia may have clarity, and during those time periods, they may want to try to gain back what they had lost through the awful disease. The likelihood of the alleged victim reporting in these situations is not what we're looking at. The concern is situation with family dynamics. You have a stepfather who is the guardian of the wife. The adult stepchildren don't like him. They help care for mom. They come in. They're helping in the physical care of her. They can see that sexual penetration has occurred, and they're reporting. If you arrest somebody on these charges, you're taking away the caregiver for that spouse. You're even for a brief period of time, and certainly with individuals who have Alzheimer's, any change in their normal routine could be disastrous. And I would encourage the committee to speak with folks who have even more in-depth knowledge than myself with dementia. Also, we have situations that are getting covered. If you look at the statute, spooning alone in bed at night when your spouse is intoxicated is covered here by eliminating the marriage defense.
Senator Wilkowski.
Do you have a recommendation on how we can solve this and protect people who are genuinely being victimized?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe that drawing down on the language specifically, I think that if I understand what the legislature is trying to accomplish here, they are trying to accomplish situations where the victim spouse is perhaps so intoxicated that they can't consent and they've been taped by their spouse. There are other statutes that do cover that. But also we do have situations where someone has been in a vegetative state and they have been taken advantage of. I think there can be wording that can, if the committee takes more time to look at the specific issue, there can be specific wording that will get to what the legislature wants without casting the net as broadly as the language prior to being taken out of this bill.
Follow-up question, Senator Wilkowski?
I was going to ask about the technical caps and the discretionary parole. If
go ahead and ask your question. I see no other questions from committee members. So,
thank you. Did you have an opinion? Those are two other issues that are, I guess, in dispute: technical caps and discretionary parole.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, with respect to technical caps, the elimination of technical caps is going to create more hearings on violations. What my lawyers have seen is that when somebody has a technical violation, they know exactly what they're going to get for time. They typically, more often than not, they do not ask for a contested hearing. They do their 3 days or they do their 5 days. So without the technical caps, there's going to be a lot more contested hearings. With respect to discretionary parole, we don't handle a lot of discretionary, we don't have a lot of parole hearings, but just from a general aspect of plea deals and the like, it will have an impact on defendants' considerations of whether or not they're going to take those deals if discretionary parole is not available to them.
We have another question, Senator Wilkowski, and you have another one in the queue?
I would. Just on the technical caps, one of the things that I've heard is the bill as it's currently written has for the first offense 3 days, and these are technical violations. Maybe somebody showed up a few minutes late for a meeting, for example, and the idea behind 3 days is, well, this person could have a job, they could be getting their life in order, they made a mistake. You give them 3 days, they can serve it over a weekend without losing their job. Is that an accurate sort of depiction of what often happens or what may happen?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, yes, that's correct. With something like a three-day technical violation, it's similar to maybe a first-time DUI offense in that the person can usually serve those days or make arrangements to serve those days without completely upending your life. If you're out on probation or even parole, there are a lot of demands on you as to what you need to do to succeed, get employment, get housing, get benefits. And when we interfere with one of those for just a technical violation, we we take away their ability to succeed. And what we want is to create situations where more people are likely to succeed on probation and parole, not less.
Okay. Other committee members have questions? Seeing none, thank you, Ms. Goldstein, for your help today. Next up, Jane Stitson from the Office of Public Advocacy. I see he's online for questions. Do you have any comments on this bill first before I have committee members express their questions?
Through the chair, I'm more than happy to take any questions. I might be able to provide some insight into the firearms NICS registry. The Alaska statute, well, if you, do you want me to continue with that, or would you like me to go over the fiscal note first?
First, I'd like to know who you are and who you represent. And then, you could go over the fiscal note also, and then make your comments on the firearms if you'd like.
Right, certainly. For the record, this is James Stinson, Director of the Office of Public Advocacy. My OMB component number is 43. OPA is requesting $694,700. That's for a total of five positions. Three of those are attorney positions. Two are support staff positions. To largely echo the comments of Beth Goldstein, that takes into account the increased felony prosecutions as part of recriminalizing misconduct involving controlled substance in the fourth degree. The administration, as well as the Department of Law, has indicated that they're going to very vigorously prosecute those drug cases. So that accounts for two of those attorney positions and a support staff position. Additionally, driving with license revoked has been recriminalized. That accounted for a very high misdemeanor case volume. So that's where those additional positions are coming in for the Office of Public Advocacy. On the whole, some of the changes to parole that have been discussed will also increase the workload on the defense side, not necessarily as much on the prosecution side, but just looking at it big picture, if there's going to be more people in custody, that does tend to put more strain on defense attorneys who then have to spend more time visiting people in custody. It makes it more difficult to defend cases. So on the whole, that's where that fiscal note is getting those figures.
So if you could help me, please. I see your fiscal notes, like you'd mentioned, $694,695 rounded off. So if I backed up to previous to SB 91, then looked at SB 91, would I find a decrease in $695,000 and a decrease in employment because of the effects, potential effects of SB 91?
So through the chair, I can tell you the Office of Public Advocacy has received no new criminal positions, I think, since 2012, and I can tell you that caseloads have steadily increased. I think they've been up approximately 33%. We've seen those, as well as our Child in Need of Aid civil cases, continue to rise, likely due to methamphetamine and opioids. So in terms of answering your question, what I can tell you is the workload certainly has not decreased. It has increased and continued to increase. As to the causes of that, I can speculate on that, but I think it's a fact that cases have gone up, and I would assume that the public defender would agree with that.
Okay. Go ahead and continue your comments, please.
So aside from that fiscal note, in terms of how the mental health registry, the NICS registry, would impact Alaska, I think the Alaska statute that references the federal law is section 47.30.851. That's the Alaska statute. It says relief from legal disability. I would encourage Mr. Skidmore to review that one. That references the federal law, which is 18 United States Code 922 G4. So that would be the violation of federal law if someone who has been adjudicated as mentally incompetent or having a mental illness and has been committed, that's the federal law that they would be in violation of, which I believe carries the same penalties federally as felon in possession, which I think is up to 10 years federally. I would have to double check on that. But that would be the law that they would potentially be in violation of.
I think we have a question from Senator Schauer.
I can just clarify that. I've got the title code here, and it is Any person who has been adjudicated as mentally defective or committed to a mental institution is prohibited under federal law from shipping, transporting, receiving, or possessing any firearm or ammunition. Violation of this federal offense is punishable by a fine of $250,000 or imprisonment up to 10 years.
Go ahead and continue.
Through the chair, that is correct. And so that is the same as it's the same penalty range as federal felon in possession. It's just a different subsection of 922G. And the reason I have some familiarity with this is I was a special assistant U.S. attorney. So to the extent you have questions about how this might play out, I'd be more than happy to try to answer that.
Okay. Go ahead and continue with your comments.
So the way this may play out is if someone who had been previously committed, who is not currently in the registry, but is now, a substantial amount of time may have gone by, so they might go to an FFL to purchase a firearm, right? And they may have even purchased a firearm before, and perhaps they didn't fill out the form as accurately as they should have. It can be an oversight if somebody, you know, dealt with a mental health issue in years past, but now they've gone, let's say they've bought a hunting rifle, they were able to pass the NICS check at the FFL. Well, now they might get flagged. That when they get flagged, that's referred to the ATF for an investigation. An ATF agent would usually contact them, determine if they have other firearms, and then probably contact the U.S. Attorney's Office to determine how to proceed. I don't necessarily think that they would be taken away in handcuffs or arrested, but there might be an attempt to confiscate any firearms in their possession. There would certainly be a discussion with a AUSA, an assistant United States attorney, as to how to deal with that individual or how to proceed, because they would be federally barred from having those firearms. So I think the ATF agent would have to do something. It might fall short of a federal prosecution. Also, a distinction in the law between Alaska law and federal law is the felon in possession statute under Alaska law, I believe it has to be a concealable firearm. I think part of that's tied to our right to subsistence. So you can possess a long gun even as a felon, and Mr. Skidmore can correct me on that if I'm wrong, but I believe that's correct. Federally, the possession of any firearm and even a bullet, so even ammunition, is treated the same. So as you can see in that statute, the feds take things a little more broadly than Alaska does in terms of the felon in possession. But that's how that might play out. As to the policy call on that, that's entirely up to you. But that might be how somebody would come into contact with law enforcement.
Okay. Do we have any questions for Mr. Stinson in the committee? Okay, Mr. Stinson, we don't have any questions. Do you have any final comments?
No, thank you.
Okay, thank you. And then I see here on the roster Mr. Rob, Slavin Rob from the Department of Corrections, but I don't see anybody on the list here for corrections. Do we have any? Oh, there you are. And it's a gal. Sorry about that. Sneaking up on me in the afternoon. I was expecting the big burly prison guard, but if you could go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, I'll straighten the chairman out on how to pronounce your name, and then help us with this legislation, it'd be appreciated.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and it happens all the time. For the record, I'm Sylvan Robb. I'm the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Corrections. The department has 7 fiscal notes that we'll walk through today, and if I may have your indulgence, Mr. Chair, I think there's an order that makes it easier to understand these, if I may. So as the department always does, we started by pulling data from ACOMS to look at the historical impacts that we've had from changes to the law, and through that we calculated the expected change to the inmate population as a result of this bill. There are a number of things that have substantial impacts on the number of inmates. As other departments have testified to, the changes to the drug laws, misconduct involving a controlled substance, the increase in cases that's been projected will also impact the Department of Corrections. The modification to the caps on probation and parole violations also has an impact on us. Sentences for both A and B felonies were increased. Sentences for both A and B misdemeanors were increased. Discretionary parole eligibility was greatly restricted. And all of those things impact the department. In some cases, it's a larger impact on a smaller number of people, but for a number of these, it's only a matter of increasing people's length of stay for a few days. But for example, in the case of misdemeanor A's, you know, we see more than 5,000 people come through the department who spend time incarcerated for an A misdemeanor. So adding even a few days to their sentence does have an impact on the department. So when we calculated the increase in inmates that we expect, so in the first year, that is 428.4 individuals, and then it continues to rise through the out years of the fiscal note, 644 in the second year, 750 in the third year, all the way up to 775, and then 781 for the last couple of years. The department currently has capacity for about 350 additional inmates within the existing system, and so additional inmates below 350, the cost for them was calculated using the marginal cost rate, and then inmates who caused us to exceed capacity were calculated at the full cost of care. And so you'll see that information on the fiscal note that's for the appropriation is population management, the allocation is the institution director's office, and it's OMB component number 1381. So, as I mentioned, we have an increased number of inmates that the department projects. We calculated the cost, some at marginal rate, some at full cost, and have those figures of the cost for each year. And the department then backed out those costs that appropriately belong in a different allocation. And so that's the result of, you'll see on other fiscal notes that we'll go through. So the institution director's office fiscal note reflects the costs that remain when we've backed out the other costs. So in the first year, we see a cost of $4.6 million and then continuing to go up through the out years.
Just took a while to find the note. I've got about a dozen of them up here. So I was trying to pay attention to what you're saying. On the marginal cost issue, there's been some debate within the budgetary process as far as that being a good number or a bad number, and can you enhance the committee a little bit on the marginal rate and the pros and cons of that?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. I'll start a little bit further back, if I may. So the department each year calculates a full cost of care for housing an inmate. This is done using a methodology that is prescribed by the U.S. Marshals Service. Every state Department of Corrections that wishes to bill the federal government for housing inmates uses the same methodology. It's extremely inclusive, includes direct and indirect costs. And within those costs, then, the marginal rate is calculated using that same methodology from the U.S. Marshals Service. And so it is the full cost of care, which just for reference is $168.74 a day. And backs out the cost for personal services, the cost for utilities, and facilities capital improvement projects. So the marginal cost of care, which is $44.98 a day, includes all of those costs that I mentioned in the full cost of care, with the exception of staff, utilities, and capital improvement projects.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I will move on to a second fiscal note, which is for the appropriation population management. It's the allocation is Palmer Correctional Center. It's OMB component 712. And I'll pause for just a minute so people can look at the right sheet.
That was OMB component number 712?
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Senator Wilson.
Before we go on, I do have a question on the last note, the 1381 note, in terms of the health care cost for the existing, and why the, if you can explain the large jump from year one to year two, three, four, and five.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, we do have a note for physical health care, but the difference in the cost from the first year to the second year, so we do anticipate the projections are that this will push us beyond our capacity, so we will need to open Palmer Correctional Center, and as part of that cost for health care, we calculated the portion of the cost of care that's for health care for the increased number of inmates. So part of the increase from the first year to the second year is reflected in the increased inmates. So in the first year, the department projects that we'll have 78 inmates who exceed our current capacity, while in the second year, we think there'll be 294. So part of that is for the daily cost of care for health care for an extra 216 people. But the other difference is that we also need to hire some medical staff to work at Palmer Correctional Center, and so you see those costs reflected in there as well, which I can talk about when I get to the physical health care note as well as the Palmer note.
Just as that, then, you know, I'm looking at the different notes, and you're about to go to the Palmer one next. So is there overlapping notes in the costs in these notes then?
Through the chair, Senator Wilson, there is not. It's very complicated, and I apologize for not doing a better job explaining it. So we calculated the cost of care for the increase of inmates. And so, for example, in the first year, the cost of all of these new inmates, so 428 new inmates, is $10.6 million. And then we backed out from there and said, okay, what portion of that $10.6 million is health care? And that's reflected on the health care note. What portion of that would be required to run the Palmer Correctional Center to accommodate the extra inmates that we do not currently have capacity for? That's reflected on the Palmer note. And then the final thing that was subtracted from that overall cost is the utilities for the Palmer Correctional Center, because those do have their own appropriation.
Yeah. Thank you.
Can we go ahead and continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So again, we're looking at the Palmer Correctional Center note, which is 712. So the department projected that in the first year of this, that we would need to start opening the medium security portion of the Palmer Correctional Center. So Palmer has a total capacity of 503 beds. The medium security portion has a capacity of 327. We obviously don't need 327 the first year, and it will take some time to get the Palmer Correctional Center ramped up and ready to accept inmates. So this note reflects some startup costs that you'll see in the services and commodities line, and those are for things like getting the boiler serviced, making sure that the fire suppression system is still functioning adequately, a number of service costs such as those. There are also commodities costs. When Palmer was closed, any usable equipment at the facility was repurposed elsewhere in the department, and has avoided us having to buy that equipment in the past, but now we do need to replace it if Palmer's to be opened. So you'll see those costs, the services and commodities in FY20. And then at the bottom, again, you'll see the cost to run Palmer. And so the way we arrived at this figure, we looked at the last full year that Palmer was open, which was FY15, and took the cost to run that facility. And again, just to reiterate, that is not the full cost of caring for those inmates, but it's the cost that were assigned to that component during that year. We adjusted that for inflation, and then we are projecting that we will need 25% of those costs for the number of inmates that we anticipate having in Palmer that first year. Then in 2021, you'll see there are additional services and commodities costs. Those are for the one-time startup costs, like I described, for the medium security portion. So those are the costs, again, to get that building ready to replace the equipment in that building. And then you'll see the ongoing cost to operate the full medium security portion of Palmer. So that reflects 75% of the FY15 management plan budget adjusted for inflation. And then finally, in FY22, the department anticipates that it would need the full Palmer Correctional Center, all 503 beds. And so the amount that you see reflected in the fiscal note, the $14 million, that's the FY15, the full amount for operating Palmer, adjusted for inflation. And again, those costs are backed out of the IDO from the full cost of care.
Senator Bishop and Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that in the first year, 2020, the $7 million and change, that's just the no prisoners. That's just getting it, turning it on and getting it ready to accept prisoners.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, we will be 78 inmates over capacity in that first year. There's a smaller building at PCC that we anticipate we would be able to use for those individuals. So part of it is to get the facility up and go through that ramp up period. Folks in the department have estimated that it will take somewhere between 6 to 9 months to get the facility up and running. So it does reflect the cost of housing 78 individuals.
Thank you. And just a quick follow up. Just when you repurposed some of the physical assets from there out to other areas in your system, like the transport vans that were, you know, those types of things. Is there any of those assets that you can bring back to Palmer, or you know what I mean? I mean, we're just looking to not chisel, but is there any? Have you looked, scrubbed the? I'm sure you've scrubbed it from top to bottom, and you could bring back any of those assets. Maybe you are.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, it's a very good question. Many of those things in the intervening years since Palmer has closed have been used for cost avoidance because, for example, the transport van that used to be at Palmer, instead of having to purchase a replacement at another facility, we were able to reuse the Palmer transport van. And so at this point, after several years of use, it's not a good candidate to be brought back. The same thing with some of the other equipment. Our things get heavy use by people who aren't always inclined to be kind to them.
Senator Wilson. Or you didn't have a question?
I do, but I just know if Senator Bishop looks like at a fault.
I think she's done. Are you done, Senator Wilson?
I'm good.
Okay.
We can always come back to him.
Thank you, Chair Sedman. I just had a question on terms of the medical equipment at the facilities at in DOC. Do all our prisons have sort of a dental equipment at all of them? Are all the standard medical necessities or standard across the board, or do some facilities have additional medical equipment within their facilities?
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, we do not have identical healthcare and dental services available at each institution. It depends on the location of the institution, the size of the institution. We don't have dental facilities at every, the department only employs two dentists.
Okay. Follow up?
Then, so do we, would we need to redo the entire dental equipment? I mean, just similar to Senator Bishop, I mean, do we need to include all the additional medical equipment back at Palmer Correctional Facility? If, let's say, we can either outsource that, or, I mean, Palmer is about an hour or so away from Goose Creek's medical facility, and if there's just standard routine sort of appointments that prison transport can happen, would that be, you know, less costly than maintaining their own separate facility there as well? Just trying to see the difference in terms of just using that other facility right down the road.
Through the chair to Senator Wilson, again, that's a very, very reasonable question. When we take inmates outside of the facilities, certainly there's a risk to public safety. There's an expense that comes with that because the prisoners need to have correctional officers accompany them when they're being transported, and then also while they're receiving whatever medical or dental treatment they might be getting. And then additionally, every time the inmates leave the facility, there's the opportunity for contraband to be returned to the facility. So in general, I have not studied specifically the aspects of providing dental care, but in general, the more we can keep inmates within the facilities, the less expensive and the safer it is.
Okay. Go ahead, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. Just by 2022, it looks like you're adding 104 new positions, and yet your costs remain the same at $14.13 million every year. And I'm just curious, it doesn't seem to account for inflation or increasing costs.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, the fiscal note instruction specifically requests that people not account for inflation in out years. But we do, you will see that there's an increase between FY21 when we go from 73 positions to FY22 when there's 104. So the cost goes up by not quite $4 million. And then that number of positions that we require stays steady for the rest of the out years. So that's why there's not a change in the cost, is because we're not adding additional people after FY22.
Follow up, Senator Wilikowski?
Yeah, and then do you have a projection on when the Palmer Correctional Facility will be full and will need a new correctional center?
When the facilities will be full, the issue of where they're going to go would be debated at the time. So I wouldn't want the public to think we're going to build another $70 million prison. So, but go ahead and get help the committee understand when the department feels that we would be at capacity.
Through the chair and to Senator Wilikowski, within the window of this fiscal note, the department does not project that this will exceed the capacity with our current institutions and the addition of Palmer being reopened. So we're projecting that this bill by the sixth year, so FY 2025, there will be 781 additional inmates. Again, reminding the committee that we have room for 350 in the current system, and then Palmer has a capacity of 503. So we'll be just under.
Okay, and I guess the future will tell us how the capacity issues goes, and we'll deal with it at the time. Other questions, Senator Wilikowski?
I do. So Section 46 increased the amount of time that a person who was arrested could be kept in prison from 24 to 48 hours. Can you show me where that's reflected in the fiscal notes?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, it will be talked about on the institution director's office note, which is 1381. And one moment, let me.
Page 2, 5th paragraph.
Okay, it's page 2. It's about a little more than half the way down, but does it have an amount there?
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, the department was not able to project an amount for this change. We do not track exactly when inmates appear before a judge or magistrate.
So could you please pull your mic a little closer? Just pull on and it'll come. Senator Wilikowski.
Another thing on Section 50, page 33, this was flagged by the court system. It changes the requirement that the correctional facility cannot release a person who is intoxicated. Basically, it requires that you shall have a breathalyzer test before releasing them. And I'm wondering where that cost is reflected in the fiscal notes.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, this is not noted in our fiscal notes. It will not have a fiscal impact on the department because it is our current policy that we don't release individuals who are intoxicated. It's not safe for them.
Do you do breathalyzers on everyone who's intoxicated before you release them?
I don't know if she's the correct person to be asking that question to, but
corrections.
Through the chair to Senator Wilikowski, the chair is right. I'm not the best person to answer that, but we do have breathalyzers, and I can't say for sure if we do it on every person before we release them.
Mm-hmm. Senator Machicki, you have a question? Okay. I thought you were twitching your finger at me. Are there questions on this fiscal note before we go on to the others? We got about 20 minutes left, so we want to get through these.
So moving on, the next fiscal note we'll look at is appropriation health and rehabilitation services. The allocation is physical health care, and that's OMB component number 2952. We've talked about this fiscal note a little bit already. So you'll see costs in the personal services line. These are for the additional medical staff for the Palmer Correctional Center. It does detail exactly the staff we need, but it's nurses, a mid-level health professional, some mental health providers. And then the amount that varies in the miscellaneous line, again, that's the cost of care amount for physical health care multiplied by the number of inmates over our current capacity. And that health care portion of the cost of care is $36.84.
Go ahead and continue. And then if we could, before you jump on back on Palmer, so you guys have accounted for any capital costs that would be impacted to get that facility up and running. Is that correct in your notes?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the repairs that are needed are reflected in the services. My understanding from our facilities folks is that it's small things.
That's fine. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There was also, I don't see it in there, I might have missed it real quick, but we had that with the hepatitis testing, which was a significant increase. Is that included in here somewhere? And I'm saying that because based on the number of prisoners, I probably missed it. So, anyway.
Through the chair to Senator Schauer, it's nothing in this bill changed the department's requirements as it relates to hepatitis C testing or treatment, and so it's not reflected in these fiscal notes.
I just wanted for the record that we noticed in DOC's budget that if we have this inmate increase, it's going to be a significant cost driver, because I think it was a $10 million add, I think it was something. It's not insignificant, so if the prisoner go up, it's going to be, I don't see it. So.
Okay, Senator Bucicki.
Just to clarify, because another member asked me, my understanding is that we have made it clear that we don't support moving prisoners outside in the budget document. If we need Palmer, we're not talking about any other currently operating facilities. We're talking about perhaps needing Palmer for the excess if these bills result in additional need in corrections. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Machiki, if I followed your question, I believe your question is if with the increased inmates that push us over capacity, these fiscal notes reflect the department's intention to house those inmates at Palmer Correctional Center.
Follow up?
That's assuming that all of the other facilities currently operating remain open and we need additional capacity. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Senator Machiki, that's correct. This is based on our current capacity of all the facilities that are open today.
Thank you.
You have a Senator Bishop.
Just a footnote, because I think you were out just a little bit ago when she said this number, Senator Machiki, but you got space for 350 right now in the current system, correct?
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, that's correct.
Thank you.
And continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That brings us to the next note. The appropriation is 24-hour institutional utilities. The allocation is the same. This is OMB component number 2976. So this note reflects the utilities for Palmer Correctional Center. As I discussed at the beginning when we started this conversation, the department expects to open a portion of the medium security Palmer Correctional Facility in the first year. So the utilities costs that you see reflected are 50% of the utility costs. Then we go to 75% for FY21. And then in FY22, it's the full utility costs that we project. And that's based on past utility costs adjusted for inflation.
Okay. Next item.
The next fiscal note is the appropriation is population management. The allocation is the parole board. It's OMB component number 695. This is a zero fiscal note. There are changes to parole and discretionary parole contained within the bill, but the parole board believes that they can meet the challenge with the with the existing resources that they have.
We like those notes that are zero, by the way.
And then you'll like the next one too, Mr. Chair. So the next note, the appropriation is population management. The allocation is statewide probation and parole. This is OMB component number 2826. Another zero note. And again, there are changes that are made to probation and parole, but the division analyzed the workload and they believe that they can meet the need with existing resources.
Okay. And do you have a total, roughly off the top of your head, of your requests, roughly?
Mr. Chairman, there is one more fiscal note. It's for $100,000, and then I will answer your question. So the appropriation is administration and support. The allocation is information technology, MIS. It's OMB component number 698. And so the $100,000 one-time request here is to hire programmers to update the Alaska Corrections Offender Management System, given the effective date of this bill and the broad changes that it makes to earn compliance credits and discretionary parole eligibility. A number of programming changes will be required.
Okay. And now you can give us a rough total.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the cost for the first year is $10.7 million for all of these fiscal notes. For the second year, it's $24 million. The third year is $30.5 million. Fourth year is $32 million. And then the fifth and sixth years are $32.4
million. Okay, so we're looking at basically going up to, within 3 years, up to the mid-30s. $35 million, you said in year three.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, do you have any other comments for the committee before we let you off the hot seat?
No, thank you.
Any other questions before we wrap up? Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Just briefly, I didn't see it in there, but I haven't read it for granular detail, but it appears that there's a couple of reg packages that you're going to have to write, and I didn't see them reflected anywhere in the notes, and I'm assuming that that's a good sign that you can eat that in-house.
Through the chair to Senator Bishop, I will double check on this. These are draft notes. It's
thank you.
A lot to go through.
Other questions for Department of Corrections before we finish up this afternoon? Senator Wilson.
I do, Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure if we have the right person here at the table to answer the questions. I have a question on sort of on the geriatric release issue, and that's not really, it hasn't been covered. It's still original part of Senate Bill 91. That talks about the someone over 60 years of age and the probation and sentencing. I just have just a couple of questions on how that's been managed or if that's been working, number of prisoners released, is that effective, recidivism rates? I'm not sure if that.
Well, I'm not sure either. Mr. Skidmore, could you come forward, please? I guess I need some help with that question. I don't know quite who to fire it down to, and you were the smiley face that was close to the aisle, so you were point man.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wasn't aware that I was smiling at that question, but I appreciate the offer. For the record, my name is John Skidmore. I believe the question that was posed by the senator was about geriatric parole and how frequently it's being used. Am I correct about that?
Yes.
So through the chair, Senator Wilson, I'm not in the Department of Corrections, and so I'm not the best person to tell you how frequently that's used. I don't know if Jeff Edwards is still online or not.
Don't see him.
Okay. So I don't know how frequently people are released on geriatric parole, and I couldn't answer that for you.
We could have the department. You don't have to venture a guess. We'll have the department get back to the committee on that. Senator Schauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question since we're in summary kind of wrap-up mode for Mr. Skidmore. This morning we talked in summary. I've had a chance to think about a lot of this over the last couple hours, but we were discussing the HB 49 and whether or not this bill was, how good it was, the ability to provide tools to prosecutors, law enforcement, et cetera, to try to solve at least a portion of the problem that we have, and whether or not what has come from the House, and then whether or not the approach we were taking in the Senate, was it better? And I didn't have a chance to ask that question directly. And so as we have gone through this, because I think we're seeing a lot of different thoughts from different groups about what is the best approach. From your perspective, is what we, well, that's my question, I guess. Is one path better than the other? Do you have a position or an opinion on all these different things we're looking at? Because we're getting into some nuances, but there's the broader part of the tools provided, and that's what I want to know. Are we giving enough tools to the appropriate groups based on what was originally asked for versus what we have now?
Mr. Skidmore, if you can help Senator Schauer with the golden answer, if you can have a golden answer for this complex question or subject.
Through the chair to Senator Schauer, what I have previously indicated is that HB 49, as it had existed in the other body's finance committee, would effectively repeal and replace SB 91. And the question that I had posed to me is, would SBs 32, 33, and 34 effectively replace and repeal SB 91? And the answer is also yes to that. So then the question becomes, what's the real difference between the two? And the way I would describe the difference is that 49, as it had existed in finance and the other body, certainly gave us a number of tools that we needed and that were very important. But the work that the Senate has done in SBs 32, 33, and 34 would give us more tools. And there are maybe a couple of changes that could be made in those packages, in those bills, but they certainly give us more tools and are more helpful to us than what comes out in 49. So I'm not saying that either one is bad. I'm saying that both are good. One gives more tools than the other. So I hope that's helpful. And okay.
Pretty much concludes today. For those watching at home, the committee is in the process of constructing a committee substitute bill. On the next meeting, scheduled for 9 a.m. tomorrow morning, we'll keep everybody posted. And there will be some things included in that committee substitute. There'll be some ideas that aren't included, so we'll have time for the committee members to have the discussion of what's included in the committee substitute and individual members' thoughts on additives or deletions to that as we work through the process to try to conclude this subject by midnight Wednesday, which is the deadline for the session. So with that, we are adjourned. We'll see everybody 9 a.m. tomorrow morning. We are adjourned. So with that.